I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a moment, why conservative Republicans as well as Democrats say there's been a takeover in the Oval Office. But first, in Iraq, a high-profile Sunni sheikh who led an alliance with American forces has been assassinated. Sheikh Abdul Sattar Abu Risha, also known as Abdul Sattar Rishawi, was killed by a roadside bomb in Anbar province. Rishawi was a key figure in the Anbar alliance, which fought foreign al-Qaeda fighters in that region. He even met with President Bush there last week. And the assassination comes as General David Petraeus has been touting success in Anbar. Well, joining us with more, Tina Sussman, Baghdad bureau chief for the Los Angeles Times. And Tina, the assassination comes just hours before President Bush was set to speak to the American people. He also possibly looking to cite the success of Anbar province.
Yeah, well, that's, of course, one of the big questions here is whether what's happened today is going to have, you know, an impact on what the president says. I mean, Iraqis, both politicians and regular Iraqis, have been really glued to their TVs for the last couple of days watching the testimony from General Petraeus. They would like the idea of their country kind of going back to some sense of normalcy. But then when something like this happens, it's just, you know, it's a reminder of just how tenuous the situation is, even in a place like Al-Anbar province, which, of course, the president and General Petraeus have held up as kind of a model of what they say should be happening in the rest of Iraq.
But is there thinking in Iraq that this assassination comes to undermine the success that's being pointed to in Al-Anbar?
Well, yes. Every time there is a pivotal moment in this country, the military here basically braces for what they call spectacular attack, you know, something that's going to get a lot of attention, something that's going to, you know, kill a lot of people. Usually we anticipate a car bombing going off in the middle of a populated area. These kinds of things have come to be expected. Everybody does tend to brace themselves for awful things to happen when there is a pivotal moment in the Iraq situation.
What's the impact? You met Rishawi. He's said to be the leader of the Al-Anbar Awakening. But did he have true allegiance to the U.S.? We've heard reports that some of the Sunni sheikhs who are fighting al-Qaeda forces are saying that they'd just as soon turn around and fight the U.S. again.
No matter what his real loyalties, the fact is that he had come to symbolize the ability of people who once had opposed the occupation to basically cooperate with it in a way that brought some semblance of security to parts of the country, particularly a part of the country that for so long was the worst part of the country. You know, tribal leaders, they're acting out of self-interest. They don't have great loyalty toward anybody except themselves and their tribe. However, at least from the U.S. point of view, this was seen as a starting point.
How are Iraqis reacting? How many followers did he have?
In terms of how Iraqis are reacting, well, just to give you an example, in the neighborhood where I am, we went out and we spoke to a few people. And the overriding opinion among people, whatever sect they may come from, is that even if, you know, as one guy said, I don't think he's an angel, but he really did what no one else was able to do, which is unify the people around him and purge his province from the threat of insurgents. Somebody willing to say, okay, I've had enough, my loyalty is to my own people, and I'm going to do what I have to help them out.
Well, and Tina, one last thought. What do you think his death, Rishawi's death, is going to mean for both the Sunni coalition in Anbar province? Is that going to weaken that coalition? And for the hope of replicating the success in Anbar to other areas?
I really don't think it's going to affect the Sunni coalition in Al-Anbar. I think the biggest problem and the biggest effect it will have is on the U.S. hopes of drawing in other tribal leaders in other parts of the country. The first thing they ask for of the U.S. is better security. They want, you know, they literally want weapons. They want protection. The United States can't just go around handing out weapons to anyone who wants them. But this case today really illustrates why these guys want protection. And I think if the United States wants to keep drawing in more people to do the kinds of things that the sheikh did in Al-Anbar province, they're going to have to find some way of making them feel safe enough. And that's going to be very difficult given what happened today.
Tina Sussman is the Baghdad bureau chief for the Los Angeles Times, speaking to us from Baghdad and about the assassination of Sheikh Abdul Sattar Rishawi, the key figure in an American Sunni alliance in Al-Anbar province in Iraq. Tina, thank you so much.
All right. Thank you very much.
As we said, the president is expected to speak tonight. Well, through the eyes of Vice President Dick Cheney, the policy choices of the Bush administration, few rights for Gitmo detainees, secret CIA prisons, the warrantless wiretapping of Americans, are examples of how power has been restored to the presidency since Watergate. But in the eyes of our next guest, those policies reflect a takeover. Journalist Charlie Savage says since the 1970s, Dick Cheney and a group of lawyers unknown to most Americans have reshaped American law and government by a radical reading of the Constitution that claims the president has inherent and exclusive power to ignore the law. And that's a power that future presidents can and most likely will wield. Boston Globe legal affairs correspondent Charlie Savage won a 2007 Pulitzer Prize chronicling the expansion of presidential power in the Bush administration. He's now written a book called Takeover, The Return of the Imperial Presidency and the Subversion of American Democracy. And Charlie, welcome.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, we want to quickly point out, you write many of the actions you detail have enraged Republicans as well as Democrats. Conservative columnist George Will writes on your book flap that you identify a growing and dangerous constitutional imbalance. Let's start by painting the picture you paint of the 2004 meeting in a hospital. Alberto Gonzalez was then White House counsel, Andrew Card, chief of staff, John Ashcroft was then attorney general. It was the night before a secret program to spy on Americans without court warrants was due to expire. John Ashcroft in the hospital post-surgery. His deputy attorney general, James Comey, refused to authorize the spying. He knew his boss was against it. And Comey gets a late-night call from Ashcroft's wife that Gonzalez and Card are coming to the hospital, so Comey rushes over there as well. You know, what happens in that hospital room?
What happens is that Alberto Gonzalez goes to the stricken and medicated Attorney General John Ashcroft, who has transferred his powers while he recovers from surgery, to Jim Comey, and asks him to essentially to overrule Comey's decision not to sign off on an expansion or an extension of the warrantless surveillance program as it then existed. But John Ashcroft had already agreed with Comey before he was rushed to the hospital that that program was not legal and ought not be continued. And Ashcroft is able, according to the witnesses, to raise his head off the pillow, even though he looked terrible before, and give for a two-minute disquisition to Gonzalez about the policy issues and, most importantly, the legal issues about whether a president can simply bypass a law that he thinks is inconvenient. And then he collapses back and says, none of these things matter anyway. I'm not the attorney general right now. That's Jim Comey. Mm-hmm. And Gonzalez turns and walks from the room.
Well, and then Comey is called to the White House for a dressing down. He says he won't go without a witness, and that witness is, interestingly, Solicitor General Ted Olson. Olson leaves a dinner party to rush over. So this is an illustration of, you know, very conservative Republicans, you know, essentially alarmed at what the Bush White House was trying to do.
Yes, I spoke once to a guy named David Keene, who's the head of the American Conservative Union, which is the largest and oldest grassroots conservative organization here in Washington. And he told me the importance of this incident is this. You had there the entire top leadership team of the Justice Department, up to and including John Ashcroft, threatening to resign because the White House was taking an action that they had been told was illegal and doing it anyway, and then forcing the White House to back down just a little bit. And what that means is no one can accuse a guy like John Ashcroft of being soft on terrorism. And so this incident, now that it has come to light, frees the conversation to talk not about the policy issues, not about what should the rules be given the threats of 9/11, but about the legal issue. Is it a good idea, is it an American idea, for the president to have the power to violate a law, to bypass a law, at his own discretion, in secret? Or did the founders intend the president to obey the rules unless and until he could get Congress to change those rules?
And this debate is between the self-described presidentialists who say they're backed by the Constitution and the Federalist Papers, and the majority of legal scholars who completely disagree with them. You write that the presidentialists' idea of an imperial presidency began to gain ground in the early Cold War years when Democrat Harry Truman unilaterally decides to send troops to Korea and then seizes steel factories during the war to prevent a strike. Things like this.
Precisely. In the Eisenhower administration, the use of the CIA to take warlike actions without consulting Congress, balloons, the term executive privilege as a means for keeping information secret from Congress is coined. The Supreme Court creates a precedent for called the state secrets privilege, which allows the White House to shut down lawsuits simply by saying if this lawsuit goes forward, it would violate a state secret, and so forth, into Vietnam through Lyndon Johnson. And this the power grab grew and grew, and then it peaked and intensified and peaked during the Nixon White House. And then it came crashing down again because Watergate and the disaster of the Vietnam War awakened Congress to the fact that things had gotten out of whack. Congress begins holding oversight hearings again in a meaningful way, and it starts passing a series of new laws that are designed to prevent future abuses of power, to restore the constitutional equilibrium by regulating the exercise of presidential power, by saying you can still do these things when you need to do them, but here's how you need to go about it, such as getting warrants when you're going to spy on Americans.
Uh-huh. How does Dick Cheney figure into that story at that time?
Dick Cheney joined the Nixon administration at the age of 28 as a mid-level official at the height of the imperial presidency, and he rose to the top of the executive branch in 1974 as first deputy and then full White House chief of staff for President Ford after Nixon left. And so he is getting his chance to help wield the powers of the imperial presidency at the very moment in which those powers are being taken away. And he's going to spend the next 30 years of his career working to try to roll back those reforms, to try to put presidential power back at the peak levels that it had briefly enjoyed at the moment before Nixon fell.
That brings us to the 1980s, the Reagan era, Dick Cheney now a congressman. And after the Iran-Contra investigation finds fault with the Reagan administration, Cheney writes a dissenting opinion, essentially saying the president has a right to break the law. It was considered pretty wacky at the time, but what happened then?
Well, the Minority Views Report in the Iran-Contra scandal essentially sits on a shelf and gathers dust for the next 20 years. But then in December of 2005, a couple days after the New York Times reveals that the Bush administration had authorized the military to wiretap Americans' calls without warrants, despite a 1978 law that requires the government to obtain warrants, Dick Cheney's on a plane with some reporters, and he's asked about this, and he explains that he thinks this was perfectly legal, perfectly within the president's rights, and he says if anyone wants to understand why they think this, they should go back and find his old Iran-Contra report. And so when you look up that report and you blow the dust off the cover, you can see that this was a theory of presidential power that puts the presidency beyond sort of the reach of regulation, beyond the rules that have been developing for 20 years, and now as the most powerful vice president in history, Dick Cheney was in a position to have a president actually act on these theories, and so to convert those theories into facts, into historical precedents that future presidents will also be able to cite. Say when they want to bypass a law or a treaty, they can look back to the early 21st century and say, it must be true that this theory, the presidents can do this because it has been done before.
That's Boston Globe legal affairs correspondent Charlie Savage. His new book is called Takeover, The Return of the Imperial Presidency, The Subversion of American Democracy. In it, Republicans and Democrats make the case that the Bush administration, led by Dick Cheney, has put the office of the president above the law. We'll have much more with Charlie after a break. Also, before we go today, we'll have some of your letters. Back in a minute, here and now. We're back with Boston Globe reporter Charlie Savage. His new book, Takeover, The Return of the Imperial Presidency and the Subversion of American Democracy. Charlie, you write how anonymous lawyers in the Bush administration, people like John Woo, David Addington, picked up on conservative Reagan-era legal ideas and develop a radical, to most scholars, theory, claiming that the president not only had full control over congressionally created federal agencies like the FDA, but also exclusive power over all foreign policy and national security matters, which they said Congress could not regulate. And they point to a fascinating case called U.S. versus Reynolds, which presidents, but especially President Bush, have used as precedent for decades to shut down lawsuits by claiming to protect states' secrets. Now, this is a case involving three scientists who were working on missile research when they were killed in a plane crash in 1948. Their widows sued, seeking access to the crash reports. The Truman administration said no, claiming state secrets. But then in 2000, the daughter of one of the scientists finds the crash reports on a website and finds what?
There was no classified information at all in the crash report.
No, it actually just told about malpractice, negligence.
The Air Force had been negligent in not training the scientists how to get out of the plane if there was a problem, and they'd been negligent in failing to install some heat shields around the engines of the plane, which is why why it had caught fire and why there was this crash.
And she thought surely the use of this precedent would be, you know, overturned, that people wouldn't be allowed to use it anymore. But
her insight was, this thing is being wielded so aggressively, but it's all based on a false premise. You know, it turns out that this thing should have been made available to these widows, and it was, and this power, this new power that was sort of invented at that moment, was immediately used for an abusive purpose. And so they filed a new lawsuit to try to get this decision overturned on the theory that the court had been defrauded by the government. But the case was thrown out of court.
Charlie Savage, do you see these expanded presidential powers that we've been speaking of being rolled back, especially in light of the fact that it was Vietnam, ultimately, that led Congress to rein in Nixon's presidential powers and led Dick Cheney on his campaign to restore those powers? And now here we are in another war, one that's very complicated. Will the war in Iraq, do you think, lead to the same pushback from Congress this time around?
Well, there's two books out right now, mine and Jack Goldsmith's. Jack Goldsmith is the former Office of Legal Counsel head who had first decided that the warrantless wiretapping program was illegal and also withdrew some torture memos.
Another very conservative Republican who, as you write in your book, turned out to be one of those who tried to stem the tide of this expansion of presidential powers.
And his book, my book, is sort of aims to be this sort of comprehensive story all over the place. Who were the people being named to the Supreme Court? What is the secrecy agenda? How the, you know, the internal fights over the executive branch, the Justice Department, politicization, how does that all fit into this overall pattern? Goldsmith focuses just on what he was an eyewitness to, but tells this very dramatic story from his own experiences of the effort to free a president's hands from laws and treaties. In many respects, our two books complement each other, but there is one respect in which we disagree. Goldsmith argues that the Bush administration overreached by going it alone so much instead of going to Congress and asking them to change the rules and getting all of their legal theories on a firmer footing, and that it's created a backlash which is actually going to weaken future presidents because no one's going to give them open-ended authorizations to use military force and so forth anymore, at least in the short term. And that's undoubtedly true to that extent. But I think that this, over the long run, will turn out to have been the most successfully implemented policy of the Bush administration. I think that they have succeeded in establishing a slew of precedents that, especially after a few years have passed, the players are different, whatever backlash does exist is sort of faded away. Future presidents of either party will be able to cite when they want to take some, you know, structurally similar action, but in some other, you know, controversy that we can't anticipate now. The precedents on the books expanding government secrecy are still there. The laws that this administration has been able to get, especially the Republican-led Congress, to pass, locking down its ability to hold U.S. citizens without trial by naming them as enemy combatants, giving the president the power to impose martial law over the objections of a state governor, taking away the habeas corpus rights of detainees and so forth, these are still on the books, and they're going to be with us, in addition to these precedents of being able to operate outside the bounds of treaties like the Geneva Conventions and other statutes. And so over the long run, I think that this is with us now.
Well, and you write that President Bill Clinton also expanded his office's powers, sending troops to Kosovo, at least initially keeping his wife's health care task force under wraps. But you write about conservative Republicans who are alarmed at what the Bush administration has done, in effect because they see perhaps there might be another President Clinton on the horizon who will then have these powers established by the Bush White House.
This is certainly one of the critical insights. I mean, that is that executive power is not a partisan issue. And the conservatives who look at a book like this and sort of overlook the George Wills of the world who are endorsing it and say, oh, this is just Bush bashing, unless they think that America will never again elect a Democratic president, they are being short-sighted. It's in the long-term interests of all Americans, regardless of politics, to maintain checks and balances and to maintain the sort of existing constitutional structure that we have all inherited from the founders. Bill Clinton, like every other president, did take some steps to expand his powers. This is a long-term trend. But on the other hand, he had a Republican Congress for most of his tenure that pushed back, as we remember very vividly. What has happened in the last 6 or 7 years is that the very conscious and deliberate agenda of expanding executive power wherever possible has thrown that trend into overdrive, and the contingent context of having a post-9/11 environment for most of that and having one-party control of government for most of that has allowed it to go much further and much in a much stronger direction than any president in recent history.
Boston Globe legal affairs correspondent Charlie Savage, his new book is called Takeover, The Return of the Imperial Presidency and the Subversion of American Democracy. Charlie, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me on.
Okay, we look ahead now. Tomorrow on Here and Now, a new policy on what religious literature is acceptable in federal prisons in post-9/11 America has left some inmates and chaplains in a tizzy. Also, the new film Across the Universe uses Beatles music to tell a 60s tale. That's all tomorrow. Still ahead today, if just about everyone agrees that there is an emergency called global warming, why is there no federal energy bill yet? That's after the news, Here and Now. Some energy news now. Oil prices continue to rise despite OPEC's announcement yesterday that it would increase production. Also, a federal judge in Vermont ruled yesterday that states can impose individual emission standards for greenhouse gases. That state right had been challenged by auto manufacturers on the grounds that it would usurp federal authority. A similar case is still pending in California. And that ruling comes as a large comprehensive energy bill is stalled in Congress, dimming hopes for meaningful national measures to conserve energy. Well, for more on all of this, we turn to Peter Butel, energy analyst and president of Cameron Hanover. And Peter, let's start with what would seem to be the simplest question. Why did oil prices start rising immediately after OPEC announces an agreement to increase production? You'd think we'd get just the opposite.
Well, it is a simple question. Unfortunately, there is no simple answer. There are a number of factors. Let's start with a lingering worry that this market has. After Hurricane Felix went from a tropical wave on a Friday to a Category 5 storm on a Sunday in record time, A lot of people are very concerned that any tropical wave that passes over the Western Caribbean and then happens to be on course for the U.S. Gulf could be a monster like Katrina or Rita, which could cripple U.S. Oil facilities.
Well, and analysts are saying that because of global warming, hurricanes do develop more quickly, become more intense. There's still debate as to whether or not there are more of them, but they do more quickly rise in number, as you just pointed out.
Well, yes, Felix was definitely the most quickly developing Category 5 hurricane that we've ever seen. Normally, it's a 7 or 10 day event where you go from a tropical wave, then your depression, then your Category 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. This happened in about 50 hours, so it was absolutely alarming to the market. We also had this week a Department of Energy report that showed both crude oil stocks and refinery utilization lower. Now, normally, if refineries are taking more crude and processing it, you will see the refinery utilization up and crude oil stocks down, but that means you're going to get refined products, gasoline, diesel, jet fuel, later on. To see them both go lower was kind of a blow to the supply side because it meant we're losing crude, but we're not turning it into refined products.
Where's it going?
Well, I think that it's just being used for other things right now. Maybe it's just going into storage or being traded. I'm not really sure because it doesn't make sense. And unfortunately, the numbers do not add out each week.
So we're reminded that people like you are trying to find, you know, what's happening with the oil around the world. But you also say that today's news about rising prices has to do with how traders work. Tell us about that.
Well, there's an interesting thing. Everybody's heard the expression buy low and sell high, but that's not how professionals operate. What they do is buy new highs and then sell higher, or if the market's making new lows, they sell short, sell something they don't own with the intention of buying it back at a lower price. People might not understand that, so I use the analogy of sitting on a beach. You may go ahead and put your towel down, and you're well away from the water, and the next thing you know, it's licking your feet. Well, what's going to happen next? If you sit still, it's probably going to cover you because the tide is coming in. And it is only at the absolute highs and lows that the tide turns and changes. So when you make new highs in a market, speculators will say, well, it's good enough to make a new high today. It's probably going to make a new high tomorrow. And in about 99% of the cases, if you buy new highs, you will in fact see the market go on to make yet another new high. So the fact that yesterday we saw new all-time highs in crude oil and in heating oil suggests to hedge funds that this is a good time to buy because we're embarking on an entirely new leg higher.
So they're buying up what was this extra production in the hopes of reselling it and making some money.
Exactly so.
Yeah.
We also have a market here that is watching what the Fed is doing very carefully. About 3 or 4 weeks ago, when the credit crunch first came out, we saw a massive liquidation across all asset classes. We saw equities or stock markets drop, but we also saw commodity markets drop. The Fed then injected a lot of liquidity into the markets, and then last Friday we saw a divorce where equities, stock prices moved lower, but commodity prices actually made a new high. And at that point, I realized, and as did others, that commodity traders were starting to look at an approaching drop in interest rates, which everybody believes that the Fed will do next Tuesday, as something that would take money out of the U.S. dollar and put it into other currencies. When interest rates are the highest here, everybody wants to buy dollars so they can put them in our banks and get the highest interest rate. When we lower interest rates, investors take money out of our banks because they're no longer getting the highest interest rate, and they go ahead and put it somewhere else. That weakens the dollar, and the dollar is how oil is priced. Oil is priced in dollars, so is wheat, corn, sugar, gold. All of these are priced in dollars, so a weaker dollar is an automatically implies higher commodity prices. And yesterday, because of dollar weakness, we saw a large amount of money moving into almost all of the commodities. So these four factors, fear of a storm, seeing both refinery runs and crude oil stocks lower, then lower interest rates, lower dollars, higher commodities, and then, of course, the general fear that we're seeing here that new high prices are, in fact, going to be indicative of new high prices regularly. All of these factors came together and have given us new highs, and in fact, they look like they will continue to give us new highs.
Well, we want to quickly ask you, this comes as we just said, the energy bill is stalled. The Senate and House both passed different bills. They're trying to compromise on issues to get a bill to some kind of committee. In the House, a powerful Democrat, John Dingell of Michigan, fought against mileage standards. In the Senate, reportedly powerful Republicans are blocking taxes on the oil industry. And as we just heard, a court in Vermont has paved the way for states to take over on issues like emission standards. So as an analyst, what does all of this mean for you? The feds seem unable to come up with some kind of law about conserving energy, and states seem to be pushing ahead. What does this mean for the market?
Well, they have been stalling on every energy bill since 2001, and there's a very simple reason. They just are incapable of reaching across the aisle, shaking hands, and taking the best that both sides have to offer. If we could just say, yes, we'll open up some federal lands to drilling, we'll go ahead and raise the mileage standards, we'll go ahead and have environmentalists working at the inception so that we're not destroying the wilderness. We'll also have mileage standards working with people in Detroit so we're not putting the car industry out of business. If we could just compromise a little and take the best from everybody, I think we would have gotten something. One of the things we really need to do is to set up a Los Alamos-type project where we take our best and brightest, take, you know, $100 billion that is being spent on somewhere far away right now, and put them there and say, don't come out until you come up with a new technology that will give us some form of energy independence.
Peter Boutel, energy analyst and president of Cameron Hanover. Peter, thanks as always.
My pleasure.
And just a reminder, you can listen to today's show stream live at our website, here-now.org, and be our guest. Download a podcast while you're there. Before we go today, actor Alan Alda, now the speaker of choice at graduations and funerals. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, let's take a few minutes for your thoughts, and a lot of them recently have been about word usage. Peggy Lyons of Portland, Oregon, not to be confused with my cousin Peg Lyons from Vermont, was one of many of you who objected to my using the words rant and outburst to describe Keith Olbermann's recent commentary on MSNBC on President Bush's comments on Iraq.
Everything you said about Iraq yesterday and everything you will say is a deception for the purpose of this one cynical, unacceptable, brutal goal, perpetuating this war indefinitely. War today, war tomorrow, war forever. And you are playing at it. Playing!
Peggy writes, this wasn't an outburst. It was a reasoned, heartfelt, well-thought-out, and written message. And he is the only one willing to risk saying what desperately needs to be said. And I add that the newspaper editors that we were speaking to in the segment say that Keith Olbermann's thoughts reflected many of their readers. Mike Nave of Thousand Oaks, California, wrote after our 9/11 segments, our guest referred to the enormity of the former World Trade Center towers. Well, Mike writes, enormity and enormous are not from the same root. If you mean immensity, don't say enormity. The World Trade Center towers' only association with enormity was when they crashed to the ground. And on that same day, I read lines from E.B. White's classic, Here is New York. Well, Jeremy Reiskind of Winston-Salem, North Carolina, was one of many who pointed out that I said intimidation of mortality instead of intimation of mortality. Oh, that was my typo. And extra points to all of you who knew that E.B. White was paraphrasing a Wordsworth line. Yesterday, we had a story on Staff Sergeant Jim Scanlon of Waltham, Massachusetts, who came home after a year with the National Guard in Baghdad and hardly knew his own daughter. That drove Pat Heavener of Waynesboro, Pennsylvania, to the phone.
I had this complete wash of memory. The summer between my fifth and sixth grade, so I would have been 11, my father went to Korea, and he came back in December of my seventh grade. And it just occurred to me just now what a different young lady he must have found when he came home. And we didn't have email and telephones and things like that then. And he didn't come home for the entire 18 months. And I just was thinking of how I must have looked in his eyes when he came home. He passed away in 2000. He was a career Army fella. 25 years in the Army. Thank you very much. I just needed to kind of share that with someone.
Our pleasure. Recently, we reported on helicopter parents, parents who hover over their kids in college, and that prompted this email from Herbert Burleyung of Groton, Vermont. He points out this is not new. He writes, Pinky, General Douglas MacArthur's mom, lived in an apartment across the street from his dorm when he attended West Point at the turn of the last century, so she would know when he went to bed. But Eleanor Levy wrote to remind us that by law, parents can't ask for kids' grades. Well, Eleanor, we checked with the Federal Family Policy Compliance Office, and the law does, in fact, give college students the right to decide who sees their records, but there are exceptions. If parents claim the student as a dependent on their tax forms, and most students are dependents, or if parents take out financial aid in the form of a parent loan, then the university is allowed to share the records with the parents, but the school isn't required to do so. Finally, if all else fails, there's one last recourse for parents. They can get a subpoena to look at their kids' grades. That is a helicopter parent. And finally, Scott Morrow of Phoenix, Arizona, wanted to know what the fiddle and guitar music was that we played after our visit to the normal school in Albion, Idaho. Well, Scott, it was Josephine's Waltz by Natalie McMaster. We'd love to hear from you. Our address is letters at here-now.org, or you can give us a call at 617-358-0397. Please remember to give us your full name and town. After a break, Alan Alda's thoughts on Ossie Davis, Peter Jennings, thoughts he had to gather in order to eulogize his good friends. That's in a minute, here and now. Yes, Alan Alda is a hugely successful actor with Oscar and Tony Award nominations and 11 seasons as Korean War surgeon Hawkeye Pierce on the television comedy series MASH. He's written films such as The Seduction of Joe Tynan. He wrote and directed The Four Seasons and written a best-selling collection of autobiographical essays called Never Have Your Dog Stuffed. But to his friends and family, Alan Alda is the one to call for a commencement speech or eulogy. Here's a sample of a speech he gave at the funeral of his close friend, fellow actor and civil rights activist Ossie Davis.
When I was 25, I stood in the wings every night watching Ossie and Pearly victorious. It was one of the ways I learned how to act. His power and his spontaneity were so vivid it made the hair rise on your neck, and you thought you were looking at someone who was being struck by lightning. 44 years later, I still aspire to what Ossie had. And I hope I can have just a little bit of Ossie in me.
That's one of many eulogies and speeches that Alan Alda has collected in a new book, Things I Overheard While Talking to Myself, and he joins us in the studio with more. Welcome.
Hello, hi.
That was quite a year for you, Ossie Davis, mm-hmm. Anne Bancroft, yeah. Peter Jennings.
Yeah, and I was asked to speak at the memorial for all three of them, and it was very interesting to me that the things I talked about were not what made them famous. They were things that were very simple and personal, little moments in our lives in which our lives touched in a human way. And that threw a lot of light for me on, I guess, on my own life, because this book isn't a collection of talks I gave. It's really me trying to solve a puzzle. What is it that could make me feel like my life is meaningful? I mean, it's an odd question for somebody who seems to have accomplished some things.
Right.
And I've loved my life, but I'm greedy. I want to get more out of it. I want to get more of a feeling of long-lasting satisfaction. And I realized talking about my friends who had died, who happened to be well-known, I didn't talk about what made them well-known. I talked about how they touched me.
You know, and it's interesting, too, because we mentioned the late anchor Peter Jennings, a friend of yours, and after the Ossie Davis speech, he kind of took you down a peg or two.
He was great. But that was Peter. He was at our apartment and having dinner with us, and they were replaying the memorial service for Ossie on television. So we went into the kitchen and watched it. And Bill Clinton was on, and he was brilliant, you know, just talking off the top of his head. He was talking about Ossie at the memorial. And you could hear the people in the Riverside Church responding to him. And as we went back to the table, Peter said, "You were very good, but Clinton was brilliant." He would always tell you how you could be better. Well, but the thing was, he was always right.
And there's another moment, though, where it seems like he really, you know, Peter Jennings was a real counter for you, because another moment you're having a kind of a heated conversation, something political. And
yeah, he thought that I was being too partisan. He thought I was an ideologue. And that surprised me, because I think I'm just reasonable, you know. And he said, "No, you know, you sound like an ideologue." He said, "The other day you drank a little too much, and you were much looser and freer. And I think I like you better drunk."
Well, and the reason I bring that up is that you do the same thing for yourself. You inspect your past words, and in some cases, or at least one that you write about, you kind of said, "Well, maybe I was a little too dogmatic." And it was the speech that you gave for your daughter, Elizabeth, when she graduated from Kenyon College. When you review that, you thought what?
Everything I had, you know, I went a long time ago, I was an activist. I identified myself as an activist, and I was pretty active. But I was so upset that day that all of the things that I had picketed for 20 years earlier had only gotten worse. And I thought, well, this is some world we're giving to you. I remember saying to her, we're giving you a world that runs like clockwork. Unfortunately, the clock it runs like is a cuckoo clock.
You know, I have to say, your writing is beautiful.
Well, thank you.
And I'm going to steal for future, commencement addresses. But you yourself said that you described yourself in this particular commencement speech you gave others for other daughters, that it was the ravings of a naive Hollywood liberal. And it did feel like, I just pictured these kids sweating, and I think there were locusts.
Locusts falling out of the trees.
And they're just hearing, "Well, everything stinks, and I don't even know why you're bothering." It really was kind of funny that way.
Well, it is funny when you look back at yourself and see yourself in three dimensions. And, you know, you don't when you're doing it. And it's fun to go back and rethink it. because it's all part of trying to figure out how to do it better. That to me is the greatest pleasure. Mm. See if you can do something well. That's terrific. But then to try to find a way to do it better is even more fun.
Alan Alda, we have to ask you, we'd read your previous bestseller, Never Have Your Dog Stuffed, which is really a tragic tale of an attempt by your father to, you know, a dog of yours that died after eating Chinese food.
But then it became an image for me of not being able to hold back change in time. You know, you can't stuff a dog and still have the dog.
No. That first book, it really tells us, frankly, about your young life, born into a vaudeville family on stage as a child, your mom with serious mental health issues. Mm-hmm. That's usually how Oprah segments begin, you know. How did, you know, and they're very sad and they're very hard for people to overcome those kinds of stories. Yeah. How do we have Alan Alda, family man, by, you know, everybody's eulogizer, even keeled? What do you think it was?
Well, most of that is apparent, you know.
Oh.
But the thing is, I thought about this a lot because I did have a troubling and sometimes troubled childhood. But the thing is, I think a lot depends on what you come in with, your constitution. And I think sometimes you have just enough strength to withstand some awful things that might happen to you in your early life. But then, in addition to that, in spite of the fact that my mother was psychotic, she was schizophrenic and paranoid and alcoholic, she loved me, and I knew she loved me, and my father loved me, even though he had to be gone a lot. So I got a really powerful dose of confidence, and which helped me to deal with the uncertainty of an early life that was very uncertain.
I think it's so interesting that as you know, on MASH, with the theme song, Suicide is Painless.
Yeah, well, we never said those words.
I know.
We just played the tune.
But somehow, you were the recipient of letters of people who
were looking
considering.
They were thinking of suicide. It was amazing to me. Partly it's that I played a guy who saved people's lives. And partly it's that when you become well-known, people somehow assume that you have powers that other people don't have. And I had to suddenly answer these letters from people who wanted to kill themselves. And it took me a long time to answer the first one because I was looking for the right words. And then I thought, this is no good. If I wait this long, they could do away with themselves. So I had to figure out an answer that would work for most everybody, and I could just tailor it to each person within a few minutes and get it right out to them. So that got to be a strange feeling for me. When you get famous, that leads to writing form letters to suicidal people. That's like the word. It's like you feel like a complete phony. Yeah. But, you know, it's funny about being alive is that you almost can't avoid being a hypocrite in some way, even no matter how much you don't want to. I mean, I was saying to a friend the other day, I don't like to go fishing. People have asked me to go. I don't want to go fishing. I don't like to kill fish, but I eat fish. And I said to my friend, I let other people kill fish for me. I'm a hypocrite. And he said, well, you know, the nice thing about being a hypocrite is you get to hang on to your values.
Alan Alda, the new book is Things I Overheard While Talking to Myself. Thanks for talking to us.
Thank you.
You can listen to Here and Now live each weekday at noon Eastern Time by going to WBUR.org and clicking on the Listen Live button. You can also find us each weekday at noon Eastern on XM Radio Channel 133.